You're listening to the Untaming podcast.
Rewild the Child.
Here is your host, Emily.
Hi, welcome back to the Untaming podcast. I hope you liked last week's episode with Jen Philpott on baby-led pottying. Robin Grill is back for today's episode. Robin, yeah, my daughter is helping with this today. So Robin Grill is back for today's episode. This is a really good one. I've really been looking forward to sharing it for my family to listen to. It's a long episode, but definitely worth it. So I'm not going to hold you up with this pre-ramble. Here's a message from our sponsor. The next episode to air on the 26th of July is with another return guest, Nadine Artemis. Tune in for that one if you're interested in maintaining your children's dental health. But for now, let's hear from Robin. Wow. 58-year-old Robin Grill was born in Uruguay to Romanian migrant parents and moved to Sydney, Australia when he was 10 years old. He still lives in Sydney now with his wife Linda and has a 22-year-old daughter, Yaramin. Robin is a counsellor, psychotherapist, parent educator, international speaker and the author of Parenting for a Peaceful World, Heart-to-Heart Parenting and most recently, Inner Child Journeys. In his own words, this is his professional adult description of himself. In reality, Robin would like you to know that his life really began, at the latest, in his mother's womb. That's more relevant than most people realise, because to some extent, that is still who Robin is, why he does what he does, and says what he says. Last night, he had 8 hours of sleep, and for breakfast today, he had buckwheat and quinoa porridge with mashed banana, a little handful of black currants, some psyllium husk, coconut snow, sunflower seeds, almond meal, and goat's yogurt. Robin, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, welcome back indeed. It's so good to be back, Emily. It's been a little while since we spoke last time, and I've been looking forward to this.
Great.
As I was wondering when you would chase me up again. And do you think, Emily, we should just talk about my breakfast then instead of our original plan?
All right, yeah, let's talk about your breakfast.
There's a lot to it, eh?
Yeah. It's a tasty combination by the sounds of it.
I'm not your toast and jam kind of guy.
So you are my very first return guest, and it's a real honour to have you back.
Yep.
Your episode, the fourth in the series, was on implicit and explicit memories, which was a pretty good precursor to what we will be talking about today with your book, Inner Child Journeys. But before we get into it, we also talked last year about the deterioration of the planet and how this has been affected by the way we treat children. And today, as we are recording this, I'm in New Zealand, and this is our very first day of some minor semblance of freedom after 5 weeks of complete lockdown due to COVID-19. You're in Australia, and I wondered if you had any brief thoughts you'd like to share on our maybe on our natural immunity and our global disregard for nature.
Which, of course, is incredibly topical now, because since the last time you and I spoke, we've now got the COVID-19 world crisis. We're completely unprecedented. We've never been in this kind of territory. Mm-hmm. And the accompanying disaster of having pretty much half of the global population in home detention.
Mm.
And what a monster that has been, and we haven't even begun to discover what this will have done as a flow and effect to the economies of the world and people's livelihoods and all of the flow and effects of that. And it's so relevant to the question that you asked, because I wonder how many people have really clearly understood that these viruses don't just come randomly from anywhere. They are kind of a perfect reflection of an age-old, very core paradigm, very core attitude that we of the civilized, so-called civilized world have, which is that we are in charge of nature. We live in really in dominator cultures. Where human beings consider, we consider ourselves to be the boss, the authority, the pinnacle of evolution. We're in charge. We tell nature what to do. We control it. We are really, you could say, we are tamers. And what that has to do, before I get too philosophical, with this disaster that we have created, is that, first of all, in believing that we dominate nature, we tame nature, we have dragged our food sources out of the ecology, separated them. Instead of being permacultural, we're agricultural, and we're, instead of leaving animals inside an ecosystem, even if you, you know, for those of us that are meat eaters, which I still am a little bit, we tear the animals that we exploit out of an ecosystem and pile them together into little cages or into dramatically overpopulated industrial farming methods, which are now, if you talk to an epidemiologist, we've now understood that the price we're paying for that is that those industrial farming methods are veritable incubators. They take viruses that are completely harmless, that have been living inside the guts of animals for millennia or longer. And in those incubation systems, they mutate into these deadly pathogens. So have you noticed that we're producing, these are called zoonotic, all of our infectious diseases now are zoonotic, which means we created them by bunching animals together, tearing them out of an ecological system, shoving them together in these unsanitary farms, and forcefully mutating new viruses. All of our viruses come from that, the ones that are pathogens. So we seem to be creating a new one every year or so, whether it's mad cow disease, Ebola, or SARS, or MERS, or now COVID, or the avian flu. And then it's an easy jump for them to hit us humans. And on top of that, so on the one hand, we're creating these viruses by being the tamers and dominators of nature, instead of using biomimicry and working with ecosystems like permaculture people do. And then we make ourselves utterly defenseless by stripping our immune systems through severe air and water pollution. That's because of the way we've treated nature. By we've reduced natural breastfeeding dramatically around the world, and breastfeeding is essential for a healthy, the seeding of a healthy gut immune system, and so on and so forth. The food that we eat is an immune stripper rather than immune builder. When I say we, I mean the sort of the modern diet, far too much meat, refined starches, refined sugars, etc., and the toxins in our food. And we've, instead of using regenerative farming practices, what we're doing is we're raping the soil, and the soils get poorer and poorer in minerals with every passing year. So we are utterly disabled in our immune system. So that's a perfect storm. What does this have to do with our human-to-human relationships and the way that we raise our children? Is that taming cultures, you know, that those patriarchal cultures that we all come from and our ancestors come from, most of us, that have this belief that we're the boss, that goes hand in hand with authoritarian styles of parenting. Authoritarian means shaming and punishing. And bribery, you know, give jelly beans for the good behavior. So we raise our children in a way that goes hand in hand and parallel to the way that we exploit nature. We've for millennia we've raised children to be inside a patriarchal model of obedience and low empathy, high obedience parenting styles. We all come from that in terms of our ancestry when you live in a civilized, so-called civilized modern world. So we are now being absolutely hammered by the ecological results. of what we've done and continue to do. So there's climate change, and every year these new superbugs that we make. And all of this is perfectly, utterly, and comprehensively optional. And we have all of the understanding and technology that we need already firmly in place to move from being the people that dominate everything and tame everything to being the people that work ecologically, both in the way that we treat our non-human family, nature, that we depend on for our every breath, and in the way that we raise our children by being, you know, leaders and guides of our children, but not dominators and tamers, which is a completely different thing. In fact, it's the opposite thing. From being authoritarian to being authoritative, which is vastly, vastly different as a model of interaction and relationship. And Emily, that was the short answer to your question.
I completely agree with you. Now on to your book. So Inner Child Journeys has come out since we last spoke. Congratulations.
Thank you.
What has been the initial feedback you've received from it?
It's starting to spread out slowly, this book. The people that have delved into it are very, very thrilled by the, especially since I've been running courses, Emily, online. Everything's online now, and I've been running courses to teach people how to use the journey, the inner child journey, in simple conversational. It's just a simple dialogue, really. You can go very in-depth or you can keep it very, very short and simple. And to bring some inner child awareness and vision into our conversations, right? And so when people start delving into it and using the journey, they start feeling really, really empowered, and it's like doors open up that seemed closed before. It's a very, very dynamic process that helps you to find mobility. It's all about empowerment when you feel stuck in relationships, when you feel stuck, particularly in your parent to child relationships, to recognize what it is that's been brought up and triggered for you. And your pain, your stuckness is a signal. Through my book, you learn to see it as a signal to a deeply to a need that you have, an emotional need, a developmental need, a need that you hadn't been aware of, but this conflict that you might be experiencing with your child, the stuckness, is like a flag. It's a signal. It's a signaling system that if you look under the hood, you'll see, my God, there's a need inside me that I hadn't been paying attention to. Then my process helps you to find a nutrient that will help you to feel that need is being met in your life. It's nothing short of magical what happens next, that you start to – so when you feed your own – your inner child's need – your windscreen through which you view relationships, people, your children, the world, it's wiped clean. You can see yourself and others completely differently. I love that. I love that moment. It feels like magic. Of course it isn't, but it feels like a thrill. It feels magical. And it just opens up then a whole new range of possibilities for how to respond to one another in a way that's much more life-giving and less provocative of conflict, shall we say.
See, I really enjoyed reading your book. It took me a few months because, you know, that's life with two young children. But there were just so many nuggets of wisdom scattered throughout there, and I would get quite excited when I would see one of your many anecdotes coming up. They really helped to clarify a point, and they were usually very interesting or entertaining. You've also offered several of your own very vulnerable anecdotes, and, you know, I would want to commend you on your courage, because it can't have been easy choosing to share those so publicly.
Yeah, thanks, Emily. And I feel like if I'm inviting through my book and the work that I do, if I'm inviting you, if I'm inviting the reader to open up to themselves about their own wounding, their own inner child story, the good, the bad, and the ugly of our childhoods, you know, and that makes you feel vulnerable, that makes you feel exposed. And it just wouldn't be right for me to invite you to that place unless I'm willing to go first, or unless, you know, you can ask me about me. You know, you don't have to be the only person that's out on a limb. And that's why I thought it necessary to be self-revealing. I also find that if I write a book that gives you, you know, a set of techniques or a method, there's a potential for that to cast a shadow that says, you know, I've got it right because I'm the therapist. I've got it right. And I absolutely want to make it clear that I do not. I will always be on my own journey.
Mm.
I'm working with my own inner child, and I will be inescapably up until I breathe my very last. I really, really want to resist that misconception about psychotherapy that means you know, people have a preconception that you find your issue, you deal with it, you've dealt with it now, you've arrived, it's done.
You're a fully formed, self-actualized human being.
Self-actualized human being,
yeah.
That's only an inch away from complete nirvana.
Yeah.
And everybody that I've ever spoken to says to me, oh, God, I thought I'd dealt with that stuff and here it is back.
Mm.
And then you feel super disappointed with yourself and ashamed and mad at yourself because, you know, you've done your three sessions of this and blah, blah, and forgiven your parents and it was all wrapped up, wasn't it? And, you know, in order to, you know, look, we need a completely different way of viewing all of that. First of all, We never arrive. Growth is forever. Thank God for that. Growth can be so exciting. You know, you think you've arrived. That's sort of like a little death. There's always a new area of growth and expansion and expansion and expansion and a new layers of healing, like the eternal onion. It's just the next layer, and I think that's a beautiful thing about life. I want to say too, we don't need to have it all wrapped up, like all of our wounds are stitched up and sweet with a little pink ribbon on them. That's not what's required in order for us with each other to experience the depth of connection and contact.
Hmm.
You know, our brokenness is part of our beauty.
Yeah.
And I'm not just whistling Dixie here. I'm not just trying to say something sweet and poetic. That is my lived experience. You don't have to be well to be together. We're all fucked up in one way or another. Every person you've ever met is vulnerable to being triggered.
Mm.
And on one day, you're operating as your age, as a grown-up, as a magnificent adult. Sometimes you actually, something presses a button in you that brings out wisdom that is beyond your years, in fact. But every human alive is equally subject to being triggered and being regressed into being like 3 years old emotionally.
Mm.
15 years old emotionally, or a baby emotionally, right?
Yeah.
And that explains all of our overreactions and our underreactions. We're all in that boat. Once you really get that, you start to be able to forgive yourself, to love yourself for that, and everybody around you as well. Instead of being perennially disappointed and going, tut, tut, stop acting like a child, everybody, if you got two arms, two legs, you get regressed when the button is big enough, you know, when there's a new something really, really pushes you. Case in point, we're living in the age of COVID-19 and we're all in home detention. And people are going wild. Are you hearing how triggered people are? And it's everybody's triggered about a different thing. Everybody's getting really emotionally regressed about whatever that is for you. You know, if you've had traumatic things in your life about medicine, about illness, about, you know, physical vulnerability, powerlessness, that you don't think your body is strong and your immune system is strong, and you'll be feeling phobic levels of terror about this virus that, you know, I hear people say that the virus will come in the night and it strikes at random, and that we're perfectly powerless, like we don't have an immune system. And that's true for some people, but it's not true for everybody. And then there's the other people, you know, just giving you two examples because there's so many, but other people that are enraged about the loss of freedom, and the people in America that are marching literally with machine guns, because there's a lot of freedom wounding in the world. Like, so many of us come from mums and dads that were very shaming and humiliating, and taking away your power as a child, your power to self-express. So we grow up with incredible amounts of this internal shame. And then a lot of people get overpowered. You grow up and you say things like you don't want to be accountable to anyone. You know, there's an overblown sense of self-entitlement that comes with that. Like, nobody tells me what to do. Nobody tells me to pay tax. You're responsible for you. I'm responsible for me. Get out of my way. You know, which basically that is a perfect description of our economics and the way that corporations do business.
Yeah,
it's the libertarian and neoliberal kind of credo that says I can do whatever the hell I bloody well want, and that is regression, Emily. That's a four-year-old speaking, and in terms of the emotional age.
Yeah,
that's, my goodness, that is a heavily punished and shamed toddler who hasn't done the healing work, and then it becomes vicious, that energy, and we become entitled. And you're seeing that everywhere. So that's why I wrote this book, that unless we start to understand our own vision, perception, our own, even our own politics, and our way of reacting, overreacting and underreacting to one another, if we don't understand the wounds that all of that comes from, all we're doing is blaming the world, blaming each other, blaming our children, our partners, and acting out. So open any newspaper, what you're seeing in all of the news is people acting out on one another and acting out on Mother Nature.
Yeah.
Acting out blindly, the reactions to our woundedness that has been unexamined. So we need to begin with inner child awareness. If we can let go, you know, release the stranglehold that we have on our external world and start looking inside a bit more.
I really, because I took so long to read the book, I really struggled with how to structure this interview to offer the book the justice it deserves. So we're going to start off with maybe just you reading a few sections and then we'll talk some more about it. Is that okay?
Sure.
Yeah. So if we start on page 36.
Page 36.
Mm-hmm.
Are you sitting comfortably?
I am.
Got your cup of tea and your teddy bear? I'm going to read it to you. Okay. Our inner child is far more than a concept. He or she, like every other she or he, is alive and made of flesh. This inner child is most clearly evident in our unconscious, spontaneous, and automatic behaviors, in our habits, in our characteristic pattern-like responses. Many of our deep-set reactions, life beliefs, and emotional dispositions were conditioned by key moments we've lived, nourishing and hurtful, thrilling and terrifying, during our formative years. Powerful experiences change us because they alter our brain, heart, and gut. And since in childhood our brains were most malleable and sensitive to our environment, childhood experiences affect us most of all. Our behavior is our memory. It reveals our story. It's not that we necessarily reproduce a facsimile of how we were treated as children, but rather that our manner demonstrates how we adapted to our childhood environments. Is that a scary prospect? Maybe.
That's good. Yeah, I really wanted to flesh out the understanding of body memories. If you could maybe just go to page 106 now.
Sure thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm really trying to say there that the inner child that you always keep hearing about, and psychotherapists have been talking about inner child this and that, you know, it's not just a concept. It's on the one hand, it's a metaphor, but the reason why we keep on reliving feelings from our childhood is that it's encoded in brain matter, mm-hmm. in neural pathways, and our bodies and our entire neurology has a way of remembering the feeling of our childhood experiences all the way back to the third trimester in the womb. Mm. But maybe that comes up in the next. This is going to be a surprise. What are you going to make me read, Emily? So you said page 100 and something or other.
106.
Page 106.
Yeah.
Here we go. Our core developmental needs are universal. They follow the same biologically prescribed sequence for all babies, all children and youth, across all ethnic groups. In the same way that we all need clean air and water and a balanced diet, the core psycho-emotional developmental needs are shared by all. For example, as babies, we need to feel safe, promptly and tenderly responded to, closely held and protected. Having these needs met is essential for acquiring the deepest layer of emotional intelligence, which is about emotional security and trust. As toddlers, the attachment needs continue, though to a lesser extent. Now we find ourselves driven by a new set of needs to express ourselves, to play, and to explore. This next layer of emotional intelligence involves freedom and autonomy. The inner security and strength we bring to our growing autonomy as toddlers is dependent on how consistently our baby needs were met. There are further distinct developmental stages to follow, as you will see in Table 3, page 108, and the nature of our passage through these two early stages influence how we fare through our primary school years, our teenage years, and so on and so on. And I think the main thing I was trying to say there is that we're all totally different, unique, and unrepeatable. Hmm. And our needs are all so different, and we vary from person to person. We vary ethnically. We vary from nation to nation and culture to culture. There is just an endless diversity the closer to you get to the surface of ourselves. However, the deeper you go into our most core developmental needs, we're all identical. Mm. And I have traveled so much with my parenting courses to so many countries, Asia, North America. People are reading my books that have been translated in Europe. I'm South American by birth. My parents were Romanian Jews. I've gone all over Australia and lots of New Zealand. The same issues everywhere. When it comes to the core areas of our relationship and parenting, you talk about parenting, one of the most beautiful things that you see, or you talk about core development in people, the most beautiful things that you see is how we're all the same. I've seen it. I've seen it a million times. That's quite I find that incredibly comforting. You have to talk about both. You have to talk about individual needs and propensities, and you have to talk about what's universal too. And it's just a question of the level, what level we are paying attention to.
Yeah. Well, that's a perfect sort of, what do you call it, segue for my next question. One of the reasons I wanted you to read those was I wanted to stress how important the positive experiences are to emotional development, because I feel like we sometimes dwell on the negative experiences. But I wondered if you could explain the emotional age elevator for the listeners.
Yeah, that's a concept I come up with, and there's a really lovely illustration I had done by the artist that's worked on the book. John Cooper is in the UK, and the emotional age elevator. So I think it's like this. Several times a day, it's like we're in a lift, and we're riding this lift up and down, up and down, up and down a tall building. And every floor on the building represents one of our ages. So that the basement, and by the way, the elevator reaches the basement, and you can get out and walk about in your basement. And the basement is your time inside your mother's womb, which is important for psychological development. And people are starting to really get that. We are conscious thinking and feeling beings, able to develop memory by the latest in the third trimester inside the womb. So life does not begin at birth. It begins a bit earlier. So the ground floor is our first year of life. The fifth floor is when we were 5 years old. 14th floor is when we were 14 years old, and so on and so on. And this building keeps on adding a floor every year, doesn't it? As long as you keep living. So the penthouse apartment is how old you are now. So life presses your buttons. And when somebody presses your buttons hard enough, say you're, you know, button number 5, whoosh, your emotional age elevator rushes down, and you get out and walk about on your fifth floor, which means that you're, at least in part, you're re-experiencing sensations, emotions, feelings, and reactions that are from a time when you were 5 years old. And a little bit, it's as if you're acting out from that emotional age, and that you're seeing the world and other people around you from that perspective, you know? And you project, we project, you see, you know, people as disempowering you, you see people as abandoning you, you see people as lying to you, or cheating you, betraying you, whatever it was that was going on for you in the wounding of that time. I want to give you a positive example too, because it's not just the negative and the wounded experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever felt like, you see, when your children were babies, and you hear their voices, you smell their hair, you see their little toes, their little feet are so evocative. That presses your button. There's a part of you that travels down to your ground floor when you were a baby. If you happen to be feeling some incredibly sweet feelings, where you just overcome with pleasure and a sense of you just want to give everything to your baby and treat your baby so tenderly and protectively and listen to your baby, and that parental mothering or fathering energy that just rushes out of you, that's a body memory in part. Your baby is a trigger that pushed your ground floor button. Whooshka, your lift went down. You're retrieving a body memory that you can't even remember the story of. It doesn't make a movie in your head, because you can't access usually the narrative memory of that, because that sits in a completely separate part of your brain. Most people don't have narrative memory, story memory of their babyhood, but you feel it in your body. And you're walking about on the ground floor retrieving this beautiful stuff that enables you. Can you see the evolutionary advantage of this emotional age elevator? You go back and you retrieve this beautiful energy that you think just, you can't help yourself. You just want to pass it on, pass it forward to your child. You're accessing what was given to you. You're now giving it forward. And we've understood the word that is commonly understood is regression. We say that person is regressed, or I'm feeling regressed because I feel like I'm 11 years old, and and I'm feeling ashamed, like my somebody got mad at me and I feel like I'm ashamed and humiliated, like when my school teacher yelled at me and I feel like I'm 11 years old all over again, that's a regression. The reason I made up this very visual kind of three-dimensional picture of the emotional age elevator is I'm trying to say this is normal. It's not a pathology. You were designed with an elevator like this in you. All humans regress at least a few times every day. And it might be a very partial regression. It's very unusual to regress so much that you forget you're also an adult. It's incredibly normal, and I dare say it's helpful, and there are advantages. Two possible advantages. One, that you retrieve loving, happy, joyous, playful experiences that charge your body up, that you then want to pass that forward to another person, a lucky person in your life, right? Or you reconnect with a wounding time that speaks to you of an unmet or incompletely met developmental need, your inner child's need, that is still waiting to be met. That's why your family, your partners, your children, all kinds of things in your life, all kinds of people, press buttons on you and you go down the lift, and you'll keep on doing that as long as you need to, so that you can wake up to these your inner child's needs that have not been fulfilled yet, not been completely fulfilled. What do you do with that? It's to awaken to that. And the great news in my book is that it is never too late to complete what's incompleted. Do you understand? You can be 75 years old and find ways that are either symbolic or material to feed, to give an answer to your inner child when that inner child's voice speaks up. And there is a myriad, infinite ways that you can do that. You don't have to be a baby all over again or a toddler. You can meet those needs in a real way, in an adult appropriate way, and it's so healing and empowering and expansive. And then the magic is that you do that. You feed your inner child's need. That's why you got pushed to go down to the 13th floor or whatever. Meet that need somehow, and then your whole vision of yourself, your projections dissolve, they disappear, they vaporize. And the way that you see other human beings and yourself is like the windscreen's been cleaned. It ends up being a very profound forgiveness process. That's the accident that happens is that you end up flooded with compassion for the people that you were having conflict with, but primarily for yourself.
That's actually I've got that down here to talk about a bit further on, but it's, if there's one thing that I learned from your book, it's compassion. I think my best example is with all the neuroscience research out there now, you know, showing just how critically important it is for babies and children to sleep with their parents, or at least in the same room as their parents. I mean, I might come across as a bit of a jerk for saying this, but I had this narrow-minded view towards parents who let their children sleep in a separate room, and I would think, how could any loving parent put their own wants ahead of their child's needs? But then reading your book, I realised that I was looking at it all wrong. Like, why do these parents do this? And I usually come across things like, that's my personal space, or I want to have my spouse all to myself. And I thought, well, hang on, are these parents maybe experiencing a body memory of when they were their child's age and were sleeping alone in a room, and all they wanted was someone to cuddle them close, and these responses are how that's manifesting. And I know this book isn't about trying to fix other people, and I appreciate that it has shown me how to find compassion for situations like this that can vex me. And I wonder, you know, maybe we have listeners who are now thinking, oh yeah, that sounds like me or my spouse. Maybe you have some advice to offer them.
Yeah, really the question there is, why do we all sooner or later disappoint or wound, hurt our children, betray them, really.
Mm.
All of us do that. I didn't live up to the things that I've said in my books. I couldn't have. I wasn't going to be able to do that because, there's two main reasons. There are, in a real sense, there is for most of us a deep lack of, like an insufficiency of the support that we need realistically in order to give our children the enormous amount that they ask from us.
Yes.
You know, we try to parent in a nuclear family and it's damn near impossible for the vast majority. We do need a community to parent. We're not designed to parent in one or two. So we get broken and exhausted. And, you know, there are some real – it's not all about inner child work, by the way. The inner child journey in my book is not there for every problem. It's very specific. So that's why it won't do to tell parents this is how you do it and this is what your children need. It's not enough.
Yeah.
Because what parents need, apart from the information, and most importantly, is the kinds of conditions that make parents able to give the formidable amount that we're asked for. And parents need an enormous amount of support, and but healing as well. Because the other thing that gets in the way of seeing our children clearly, understanding their needs, but also being able to meet their needs, is how wounded we are. And the biggest conflicts that we have in parenting are a pretty faithful reflection of the biggest wounds that we ourselves had as growing up. So it's incredibly common for parents, for instance, to feel incredibly overwhelmed by babies, like the crying baby, you know, whereas for some parents it brings out this enormous loyalty and a desire to give, give, give. For a lot of parents don't have that luxury in that as babies they were neglected a lot and left to cry it out on their own. So what it brings up is a tremendous sense of overwhelm, like an overpowering sense of I can't take this, and or even an irritability. And, you know, the behavior is unpleasant, but like I said, behavior is biography. It shows you what's being done to you. It's not the parent's fault at all. You know, the parent is reliving, and usually without realizing it, but reliving a terrible wound from their own childhood. And the same is true like with every other phase of parenting. You know, people that feel incredibly out of control and very angry maybe when their children, their toddlers start being defiant and non-collaborative, and it brings out all of these punishing, shaming responses. Lo and behold, that's not because there's something wrong with the parent. But if you ask the question, how did that go for you when you were your child's age, then you have the real story that explains it all, you know. And somebody will say, gosh, when I was five, if I spoke the way my child speaks, I'd be smacked, sent to my room and locked in there for an hour. That kind of history that is incredibly common.
Mm.
You know, a lot of us experience quite a bit of brutality in our childhoods. And it wasn't called child abuse. It was called parenting. It doesn't mean that we don't grow up loving and good people, but we have these wounds, these scars that get triggered. On a good day, they don't. On the following day, they do. So if instead of just educating parents and giving them information and saying, don't do it like this, do it like that, which is probably often a pain, really, just to be told, there's a healing conversation that needs to happen, which begins with the question, like a genuine interest and curiosity into the, what has this person lived? How was that for you when you were that age? You know, and when my daughter ventured into her teenage years, probably for me as a dad, the most challenging triggers came then. And I had to revisit, you know, how my parents battled with me when I was 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21. It was hard. My parents really didn't know. They didn't know what to do with a teenager at all. They were very, my dad especially, was very suspicious of the teenage mind. And we fought, and I felt shamed. I felt alienated. I was also was mean to my parents. I barked at them quite a lot. I shocked them, and I scared them. I scared them senseless with a lot of my choices. And that I realized when my daughter became a teenager, just how unresolved a lot of that stuff still is. And my inner adolescent still wants more of my attention. And there are things that I can do for that, you know, to be a better listener, a better dad to my own internal adolescent. And, you know, my daughter just minds her own business and does who she is, and she's wonderful. And but I get quite triggered. I get frightened, you know, and I start becoming controlling. I can hear my own dad in my voice, you know. Become intrusive, controlling, and God, I fall into that trap a bit because, you know, the button number 22 gets pushed in my emotional age elevator like you wouldn't believe. I'm down in somewhere between my 15th and 22nd floor. I regress to that quite a bit, and there's you know, I'm grateful that happens. I've got a healing journey ahead of me to keep on giving better treatment to my inner adolescent. Mm.
Could you, an aha moment that I had while reading your book was the learning about underreactions. So I'm wondering if, I'm sure everyone understands overreactions, but I wondered if you could explain underreactions for us.
Yeah, that's equally important. It's 50-50.
Mm.
A sign that you're being triggered and to you know, a wounded place from your childhood, adolescence, your inner child, is that your behavior becomes automatic, spontaneous, unconscious, and automatic. And it's usually, but it's not over an overreaction. It's not only an overreaction. Most people are familiar with that. That's what you talk about.
Mm-hmm.
We're usually judging one another to stop overreacting. God, we're so quick to judge, aren't we?
Yeah.
There's a wound behind our overreactions, but there's and a deep one that hurts. There's equally a wound behind our underreactions, and we need to start to understand that better. There's so many examples of our underreactions. It's like so many examples. People that have a disengagement from the needs of their community, the politics of their nation, as if it doesn't matter, as if it doesn't intertwine with their personal lives. You know, the blinkers on. That's an underreaction. People are hurting. But I'm too powerless and insignificant to be able to respond, engage. It's a denial and disavowal of our own power, really. Here's another underreaction. You know, the great struggle that many parents have at being strong and assertive with their children. Not setting boundaries. Not saying, I really don't like your behavior right now. Not being strong that way. You know, an overreaction is to punish and shame. An underreaction is to say nothing. And I meet two kinds of parents in my work, parents that are authoritarian and kind of attack their children, and parents that are, because of their own wounding, it's never somebody's fault, they underreact and they set no boundaries and the kids just run all over them, and children that literally beat their parents or are unbounded in a way that ends up hurting the child, really. And so I could go on and on with examples, but it's important to see that underreaction is equally as common and as overreaction, and that it comes from it's a signal about a wound, an inner child need that needs to be met.
I like how throughout the book you reiterated that this is not a journey of self-obsession and preoccupation. Could you please clarify that for the listeners?
Yes, I'd like to do that. Emily, can you hold that question for a second? I just realised that I wanted to say one more thing about the last question.
Go ahead.
Just to give, it just popped in my mind. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
I wanted to give a very, very quick example. Underreaction, overreaction, where does that come from? Why do some parents, and this is just one example, there's hundreds. I'm not labouring this particular point, but it's just a good example. Say parents that really struggle to set boundaries and assert themselves with their children. If you ask them to tell their story of what was that like as kids, often it's a parent that whose power was taken away from them. They were robbed of their assertiveness. They weren't allowed to voice their feelings. They had a very domineering parent that said, shut up or be quiet or, you know, children are to be seen but not heard, that all that kind of jazz. And then they survived by shutting their voice down. Or parents that have been physically abused and then they feel just so oversensitive to ever showing emotion and intensity and assertiveness to their child. They feel like, you know, my child's, I never want to let my child feel intimidated the way that I did. So what they do is they remove their power altogether, their own power, and say nothing. Don't say boo. Don't say no, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
That's the person who grew up adapting by becoming very submissive. And then there's the other side, people that felt very bullied by their parents and their teachers. And they adapt, they have a different kind of an adaptation, which is to become the dominant person. I'm the dude or the woman. I call the shots around here, do as you're told or else. Why? Because I'm older. So it's the bullied becomes the bully. And so that's the overreactor, usually a very angry person. The other one is the underreactor, the submissive, passive person that lets the child do whatever they want. But can you see with it? That comes from a wound. And then there's, you know, the healing comes from the developmental nutrient of, you know, what did you need as a child when you were being bullied by your parents? You know, you needed to be heard. You needed to be listened to. Well, who else needs to, you know, to really hear your most tender emotions in your life now? Because if you start to set that right in your life and have a new experience, that really, really, really starts to open up the landscape to bring forth in you a whole new set of responses that are not reactions. You know, how to be assertive without being intimidating. How to be a strong leader of your children in your family without being a bully and a punisher and a shamer, etc. So the personal healing comes first. That's just one illustration. But so this is why the subtitle of my book is How Our Children Grow Us Up.
Yeah.
They do. They press the right button, the exactly the right button for you. And so your next question was about, you know, this isn't the inner child journey isn't the answer to every situation, right?
Yeah.
It's not, because don't go into introspection every time that there's something that your child needs a response. And sometimes you need this in the moment response, and that's all about skilling up. Or trusting your intuition and going with it. You know, your kid's running around madly near a 4-lane highway or 6-lane highway and you're wondering how to respond to that. Don't sit down and close your eyes and start an inner child journey, for God's sakes. You know. So when do you use inner child? When do you use introspection? First of all, you need the time. You need the space. You need to be away from your children. And right now, somebody that's a single parent with three kids will yell at me because, you know, they'll be probably saying, did you, what makes you think I've got 3 seconds to myself? I can't go to the toilet by myself.
Yeah.
I really, really understand that. And remind me to say something about the light version of the inner child journey.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't use inner child work all the time. Far from it. It's for when it becomes really helpful and I think necessary and really appropriate is as a way of treating those issues that keep on coming up again and again and again like a pattern. So please respond in the present moment. But when you start to realize that, oh, my God, every time my baby cries, I get really irritated, or every time my child has a toddler, I feel really frightened and I want to run away, or you know, every time my teenager rolls his eyes, I want to, you know, be physically, you know, violent, or I want to yell, or, you know, those things. Or every time that I need to set a boundary, I really feel helpless. I don't know how to do it. Those things that keep on coming up again and again and again that go on for a while, okay? Those patterns that we have, we all have that in one time or another, or usually several as parents. That tells you what's coming up for you is from your past. It's not about your child. You know, it's not entirely about your child anyway. It might be, you know, something in your child that does need a response, but the emotion, the emotionality that's coming up for you right now, that's getting in the way of a clear response, that's all you. But it's your history. Something needs your attention, something wants healing. Your inner child is trying to speak to you. That's when you use the inner child process, and you need, look, there's a very light and quick version of the inner child process. If all you've got is 30 seconds to yourself, or you might be sitting in the bus on the way to work, you can do it while you're looking out the window, or you can do it in depth, long, deeply therapeutic one that sometimes you can do it on your own or guided by a counselor or therapist, or you can share it with a friend. You can read out the questions to one another and go quite deep, and there's all kinds of levels in between.
Do you want to go over the light version now?
I could do, yeah, sure. Let me see how simple I can put it. It's really five little steps.
Yeah.
How am I feeling now? What are the thoughts going on in my head right now about this situation? Okay, when have I felt this way and thought or heard these kinds of thoughts in my past? What's this familiar from, in other words? So in my past, when I was going through this kind of thing, feeling these kinds of feelings, thinking these kinds of thoughts, or witnessing this around me, when I was feeling this way, what would have made me feel better? What should have happened differently? Which, by the way, that's the power question. I call it the wishing question. Because that goes from the feeling, from the pain, or the frustration, it goes from the feeling to the need. Under every strong, painful feeling, whether it's anger, fear, grief, there's a need. What did I need when that was going on for me? The next question is, how might I have that need met for me in my current life, at my current age? I'm 58, so how can I have a 58-year-old version of that need met? I'll just explain that a little bit, Emily. When you're having a conflict about something that keeps repeating and repeating with your child, you can bet your bootstraps and every hair and the ends of your chin that the same conflict, you have that conflict with your inner child, the same, the very, very same. The conflict you have with your child or with your partner or with someone at work, the theme of that conflict, you got that going with your inner child as well. You've lived it before, and you've got the same quality of conflict and stuckness going on with other people in your life. It's not just with your kid or with whoever it was that pressed your button. If you understand that, that's so fundamental, it's so important. So you're at question four, you know, where else is this going on and how can I have my needs met? And it's usually an outside need or an inside need, something that I need from people around me or from nature that I don't receive enough, or something that I need to express or give myself permission to do or say that I normally am afraid to do or say. And then step five is, well, you know, once I've made a promise to myself, I'm going to meet this, my inner child's need, or better still, beyond a promise, to actually do some act in that direction to meet your inner child's need. Step five is, well, how, you know, let's go back to the person that pressed my button, the person that triggered me. What do they look like now? What do I think is going on for them? What do they need? And if it was my child, well, what's the new thing I understand about my child? Why does my child, my actual child, behave in that weird way? What's the new understanding there? So it's a five-step process. How am I feeling? Where did this come from? What did I need when that was going on for me as a child? How can I have that now? And come back to the present. What does the world look like now? Now that took me just a few seconds to say it all out. The beauty of it, you can just have this like a conversation.
Yeah, it's true.
Just a conversation. Yeah. One of your friends says, God, every time my child does this now, I can't stand it. I want to shake him. It's just the one question. You know, okay, well, so when you behaved that way as a kid, what happened to you? Or what were you like when you were your child's age? What was going on for you? And that's not to – it's the opposite of blame. It's like a loving curiosity about that person. Because, you know, you can bet every tea leaf in China, it's not only happening with the person that triggered you, okay? That's an issue you've had for a long time. And it's at least in part yours, all right?
Mm.
And that's – you see, that's not blame. That's you know, that's help. I'm interested in you. Your inner child's calling you. Your inner child is calling, has been calling you for years and will never give up. Feed this inner child. You deserve it. And then you will feel more empowered by that. You really will. You will have better answers for all of your stuck things and conflicted relationships in your life.
Mm. Now that the audience has a better grasp on what is involved with the process, there is one question that kept jumping into my head while I was reading it. So please bear with me because it might be a bit of a long one. But I just kept thinking of people I know who, you know, on the surface they'll appear to be successful, they're maybe comfortably wealthy, they have family and friends in their lives. But when you look closer, you'll see that their social interactions are strained unless they've had, I don't know, maybe alcohol or some other type of substance. Their jokes are kind of limited to things that, you know, border on maybe a bit sexist, a bit racist. You know, they struggle to find joy in simple things like going barefoot on the grass or eating food with their hands. Something as simple and natural as children playing naked makes them uncomfortable, and you know, they'll look for any excuse to avoid playing with children because sadly they just don't know how. And
are you basically referring to Australian pub culture?
Probably, yes, that's what I mean. It's a lot of, so many people that I know are like this, and it's
I'm trying to be funny there because it's not all like that, of course, but yes, I hear you.
So I guess a lot of those people seem to think that, you know, we're too soft on children these days and anything that's wrong with the world is because we don't spank children. And I kept, when I was reading your book, I kept thinking of them and thinking they will see themselves as successful and surrounded by loving family and friends, and they'll say that they had a happy, loving childhood. They won't have interest in the journey, or, you know, they'll think it's too touchy-feely or not targeted at them.
Well, I mean, and you'll notice that with that person that I've met that person probably 40 million times.
Yeah.
And You know, and I've got the rigid-minded, stuck parts of me. Don't think that I'm, you know, like the guru that has it all stitched up. But you'll notice that person that you've described in caricature there is perfectly impossible to reason, convince, or inform.
Yes.
Because all of those kinds of belief systems that you've underlined there, they're all preconceived. It's like a priori, that's the way it is, and anything that contradicts that is wrong. So when you get that level of rigidity and authoritarianism, yes, that is a reflection of a very, very wounded state around those issues of freedom of self-expression, emotional vulnerability. There's a lot of toddler stuff in there, a lot of toddler and adolescent kind of wounds that are being the wounding speaks through the belief system of the person.
Yeah.
Okay. The belief systems that people espouse are often these kinds of indirect indicators of where the person has been really. And what you see is a brute and a bully who's stuck in their ways and whatever you like. If you see past your own projections about that, what you're seeing is a deeply humiliated and disempowered child, probably a toddler, definitely an adolescent. You know, the thing of also you mentioned that thing where I don't know how to lovingly enjoy the company of my friends and laugh out loud and have fun and sing and be self-expressive and playful. I don't know how to do that until I've had a few under my belt or smoke something or, you know, that paralysis about reaching out and connecting in a social setting. Often that's to do with our early experiences of joining a tribe. And there aren't many people that don't have big scars around that. Our time in high school, the people that rejected us, the cliques that we were part of, that we weren't allowed to be part of, the things we had to do to ourselves to be allowed to belong, the incessant humiliation that happens, the mockery, the rampant mockery that happens in our, you know, in our generation, our earlier generations, the way that adolescence played out. We tore strips off each other. We were we are shy, and we really want to play because we're in love with other human beings. We want to get out there and be free to express, but we're so terrified of that and on guard about people laughing at us or whatever it might be. And that's fine. That's a good thing to talk to each other about. That gives us freedom. The problem is only when we're unconscious of those drivers and of those wounds, so totally unconscious that then we just hit this paralysis. You know, I want to be with people and have fun and be warm. I can't bear it. I'm terrified. I don't even want to admit it to myself. I know what I can rely on is to booze up. Mm-hmm. Plus, I learned that from my parents or from my peers, you know, and the boozier I get, the more that I get slapped on the back. So we get stuck in these cycles. We get stuck and stuck and stuck, and we live the same way. And as long as the culture says that's okay, that's where we remain. I mean, it's like I said earlier, but behavior is biography. It shows you where we've been and what we're veterans of. And you mentioned how privileged we are. There's a majority of people in our lovely modern countries like New Zealand and Australia and Euro countries that we're immensely privileged. You know, there's a roof that we can count on, and there's an abundance of food that we can count on, and we get to, you know, have devices to communicate with all over the world and toys and that's a privilege. It's a massive privilege. It's quite sobering to consider how many people are robbed of that and are in live in fear, insecurity, and violence and chaos. But in the nice suburbs, in our nice streets, the lovely middle-class people that can romp off to school and take the kids to sport and have it all, as we say, it all, there's a lot of woeful underprivilege in terms of our emotional wellness, in terms of our emotional inheritance. Okay, it would shock you to discover how many of the nice people in the suburbs that give money to charities and comb their child's hair and make their lunch for them are carrying stories of being beaten, betrayed, sexually molested and abused, shamed over and over and over again, like these deep slashes through their psyche that we cover up when we suit up to go to work. We cover it over with our lipstick, our good haircuts, our politeness. We're bleeding. We're emotionally underprivileged. There's a lot of people in impoverished places that are rich in terms of their emotional fullness compared to us in the suburbs with a nice car.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so when we refer to privilege, well, we need to be specific.
Yeah. I think one of my what I wanted to ask about that as well, though, is that when you have somebody who is so stuck, like I just described, I'm sure there are listeners listening who can say, yes, that sounds just like my spouse or my parent, my sibling. So how can they help to protect their child from continuing the cycle of inherited traumas that these people who play a significant role in their child's life could inflict on their child?
Whenever there needs to be protection, do your best to think of a we and us rather than I.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if there's somebody who's completely convinced that the only way to treat a child is to punish them or let them cry out alone and on the balcony, or, you know, all of those things that are carryovers from a very, very obsolete and authoritarian age, you know, we are remembering that we are the tamers. We look at a child and the first thing we want to do is to tame that little thing. We objectify children. We call them it. The baby is an it. All of that old stuff that thoroughly doesn't work. And so when it's time to protect the child from that carryover of a wounded past, try not to do that on your own. And hey, you know, the culture is slowly evolving, or actually very, very rapidly in terms of historic time. Not rapid enough for my liking, but, you know, somebody wants to smack a child in New Zealand now, you can say, excuse me, my friend, but since 2007, that's classified as domestic abuse.
Yeah.
That's domestic violence. You're not allowed to smack a child. It'll be a legal consequence. So your country protects you there. Your government stands behind you.
It's a nice positive.
Yeah. So, you know, it's try not to be alone with those protective statements. And look, you aren't, because the exciting thing is that the overwhelming amount of conventional science, the science of neurological development, early childhood development, it's on the side of everything that children really need for optimal emotional and neuropsychological thriving. The science is on the side of the good guys.
Mm.
I mean, in droves. Old cultures, old world cultures are obsolete. They just speak through us because how, you know, unhealed wounding, but they're obsolete. You've got science to back you when you say babies are not equipped to sleep alone. you know, toddlers need strong boundaries, but not punishment or shaming. Children deserve to have a playful approach, a passion-led approach to education. They need to be supported for expressing their feelings and their opinions. You know, those things are so solidly backed by the science in every respect that you don't have to be alone in saying, do not treat my child this way.
That's true.
But there's backup.
Mm-hmm.
I could say so much more. I mean, that was a huge question. We needed hours for that question.
I know. Well, that does bring me to this next one, though, about co-parenting, intentional emotional vulnerability, doing the journey with other people and your spouse, family members, if you had anything to say on that. I'm sure you do.
Yes. And it leads in from the last question, because when somebody has a very rigidly held view, which is basically a cultural bias that, you know, children, this is what you've got to do to them, you almost never... It's only going to create resistance and an argument to try to reason and use your information and say, you know, going to the disagreement, that philosophical question, it's fruitless most of the time. Not always, but most of the time. But you can do something that's much more, it's less judgmental, by the way, and because none of us are in a position to lecture anybody, but to be curious. And it's when you ask somebody about their own story and you're coming from not some kind of an analytic space, but just a curiosity about getting to know the person, you know, what was it like for you as a child? Well, you know, when you were told you were naughty, what happened then for you? What did that feel like for you? So stories I've discovered through this work and the writing of my book, that my book was not intended as a book about forgiveness. I don't use forgiveness as an intended therapy. I let people feel as much outrage as they need to feel about things. But it ends up that when you hear somebody's story, and when they show you what this story feels like to them, not just the data and the information, but this is what it was like inside myself when I was treated like this or like that, left alone or beaten or whatever it was, your heart moves towards that person. It's, you can't even help it. The felt story is a heart opener, and it's a forgiveness engine where you see finally the person's soul, in a sense, rather than their behavior. You know, even though you might disagree with the behavior and say the behavior is nasty, but you see through to the heart. And I feel like nothing connects us to each other more powerfully than that. Any workshop that I've run where people, we sit in circle and we start sharing with each other, we start showing each other our inner child, it's immensely bonding. It creates a tribe out of people. When we see each other's inner child for a glimpse, because that doesn't stay, it's just a glimpse, it builds this loyalty and trust. When you show your inner child to the right people, you got to choose people cautiously and carefully. But when you do that, you end up receiving their compassion, their love, their affection. So that human connection is about emotional vulnerability and emotional authenticity. We don't connect at the head. We connect at the heart, and it's very palpable. The way that we get close to one another is that we open up about our deeper feelings, our vulnerability. And it's like, it's as if there is a conduit, an energy that moves from my heart to yours and back. This is how we make peace in the world, through intentional vulnerability. By that word vulnerability, I don't mean that you get hurt. I mean it metaphorically. I mean it figuratively, rather. The vulnerability, that sense of vulnerability that you invariably feel when you're open about your most tender feelings. When I can share with you, when that happened to me, I was scared, I was sad, when to tell the truth about our anger and our frustration, that makes us vulnerable. All of our emotions, the entire rainbow, the entire A to Z, as long as you're taking ownership as you speak rather than blaming. And so that's what connects us. So I use this in a child work, not because I think people have to be fixed and stitched up and, you know, we'll never arrive at that. It's that the journey makes us more open with each other, and then the gigantic and beautiful byproduct of that, of taking these journeys together, is that we connect. We really connect. It's a ritual of connection. People that walk in as strangers and they walk out arm in arm, laughing, okay, playing.
That's nice.
Yeah.
I guess as we start to wrap up, that kind of also leads into this, me asking you, what is your vision for the book?
Oh, good question. I would like to see, the book is a handbook that you can refer to. It isn't necessarily the case that you need to read all of it from, you know, from page one to page whatever. You can dip into it. It's got useful bits, and you can even just download the short and long versions of the Inner Child Journey from my website in a PDF printable format, print it out and play with it. There are safety instructions to go with it. So it's a handbook, and I'm working at creating circles, really, of people along the lines of a book club, where people can use the Inner Child Inquiry in conversation, in dialogue, to build and bond as a tribe. We all want tribes. We all want to feel like we're part of a web that way, a human web. And those kinds of open dialogues build trust, and we can use it together in a book club kind of tribal sense of even helping ourselves and each other with issues. You know, somebody comes in and says, gosh, I'm really battling with my parenting thing or with my partner right now. And by the way, the book speaks in the context of, this is for parents and teachers, and the person that is the trigger and the button pusher is your child, but you can adapt it to every relationship.
Yeah.
Every relationship. Sometimes your computer is the person that triggers you. you know those moments of computer rage when you start feeling really powerless and helpless, and you hear that voice in your head that's like your school teacher telling you how dumb you are and all of that, because your computer. So anybody's a trigger. So you can help each other with that, and take short or deep journeys together. And you know, we have become in a few short decades such a psychologically interested and psychologically aware world. You wouldn't believe how different we are in our conversations, the things that we open up about to each other now compared to when I was in high school in the 70s. Mm. It's like a new universe. And people are so much more open, and we still got a long way to go. And I think the next place to go, I want to see a world where inner child awareness is second nature, and that focus weaves in and out of conversations when necessary and appropriate. Because when you're sitting in the bus on the way to work next to your buddy and you're saying, oh, God, my kid's having a lot of tantrums right now, what a pain in the neck, you know, I feel so frustrated and exhausted. And the next question should be, well, you know, what was it like for you when you had tantrums? It should be like almost an automatic. And that's a beautiful conversation to have. And what did you need when you had tantrums? You know, that might have happened to you then, but what did you really need from your parents when you had tantrums? Oh, my God, that's such a revelation moment, a light bulb. Ah, no wonder you get this no wonder experience, right? Ah, no wonder my kid behaves so bizarre. This is what he or she is asking for without saying it. Wow, thank you for the conversation. Okay, that conversation is what I want to see all over the world.
Hmm.
Because it's just becoming aware of something that's already there. It's already there. You're not conjuring it up. You're just opening your eyes to a big part of you that's driving your experience.
It's like, I'm just looking at all the titles of your books and thinking it's like inner child journeys for like a heart-to-heart peaceful world.
That's a good combo.
Yeah.
That's a good combo. Oh, my God, don't get me started. I might have to to write the sort of the tutti-frutti multi-flavored book out of the three of them. But no, shoot me if you see me doing that.
Yeah. So where can people buy Inner Child Journeys?
It's available online. So you're mm-hmm. online seller, you know, yep. wherever you are, whether you're the Amazons or the Book Depositories or, you know, there are these other online sellers that, is it Whitcools in New Zealand?
Yes, yeah, Whitcools.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Look for it online.
Great.
If you have any trouble finding it, I'm going to be very upset about that. So send me an email. And the way to find me is robingrill.com,
mm-hmm.
R-O-B-I-N, Robin's with an I, not a Y, and Grill is with an E at the end, G-R-I-L-L-E, robingrill.com. And if you click on the publications tab, you'll see Inner Child Journeys under that. As when you scroll down the menu, click on Inner Child Journeys. It's a whole page about it. It tells you about the book. You can download the appendixes of the book. You can scroll down the page, click on the appendixes, download that. And you can print it out and play with it. I want to invite people to my website. Visit my website because there's a lot of – go to the article sections. There's really great, useful articles in there. I say great. Is that arrogant? I wrote them.
I think they're great, so they are.
Yeah. I still believe in those articles. They're really good, and I'm proud of them. And you can find out about my courses that I do, my online courses that are based on this book or other stuff. Come on in.
Great. I'll put links in the show notes to all of that, the website and all the other resources you've mentioned. Is there anything else that you'd like to add for people to be able to find you or to find out more?
You can also friend me on Facebook. Very easy to find me on Facebook, Robin Grill. Mm-hmm. I make a lot of my announcements on Facebook. Beware, I'm a political animal because I can't think about childhood and psychology and human relationships without thinking about civilization and the world that we're creating with every day and also, you know, how we have relationships, how we do our parenting, that's the world that we're creating, and that's the biggest concern in my life. Really? So you'll see that my posts are about all of that stuff. You can skip the ones that you don't want to look at. That's fine.
Robin, thank you so, so much for taking the time to come back and talk to me today. I hope the listeners have managed to get even a fraction from this interview that I did from your book. I have wholeheartedly enjoyed our conversation.
I really appreciate that. Thanks, Emily. I really I value my time with you and the opportunity that you give me to share all of this stuff with your listeners who are invisible to me right now, but I can feel you guys out there and all you folks. And I hope you all having a glorious time of personal growth and advancement and And what a hell of an adventure we have on this planet with one another. We get so lost and so hurt and so triumphant. I believe in the human animal hugely, actually. We get smashed and we keep going and loving and we're so resilient and we don't stay the same. We grow. We grow. I think the Earth wants us here. The Earth produced us. I think we've just been very, very badly behaved for 10,000 years, a lot of us, and but we're learning by our mistake. We're starting to learn. There's some beautiful new things emerging, a new possibility for civilization, a regenerative, ecologically intelligent, non-dominating but partnership style of civilization. It's a new the partnership style of family and schooling. That is growing fast, fast, fast. Be part of it. Be part of that growth.
Thank you. And I have a final question for you to end on. If the entire world's knowledge was lost and you could only leave one sentence for future generations, what would it be?
I'm trying to decide between two.
Ah, okay. Well, what are they? Tell us both.
Tell you both?
Yeah.
They might surprise you, actually.
Okay.
But I won't. I will leave them unexplained as a mystery for you to work with.
Yes, perfect.
One of them, in all things, balance the feminine and masculine. Balance. No dominance. Balance. You can let that mean whatever you want it to mean for you. In all things. The other one is learn to listen more deeply, learn to really, really listen and keep learning to listen more.
If you enjoyed this episode, you can join the discussions on our Facebook and Instagram pages. To hear more, subscribe for free on the podcast app on your smartphone. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and all of your favorite podcast platforms. If you would like to offer feedback or suggest a guest, email us at untaming.podcast@gmail.com.